Radio Real. Real radio, your reality. Welcome to Off the Shelf,
the show for book lovers, featuring authors, publishers, storytellers, and readers.
I'm Kegia Gherardi.
This is Simeon Beresford.
Join us in our wanderings through the literary world. We have another great interview today. Christine Catherine Rush is what I'd call the total package. She writes fantasy, science fiction, mystery, and romance.
An editor and publisher herself, she shares her knowledge on her website. Let's see what she will share with us.
Welcome to Off the Shelf.
Well, thank you, and thanks for asking me to come.
You are such a prolific writer that I suspect you write in your sleep. Do you have a routine for your writing that you follow, or do you just kind of, whenever the mood strikes you?
Oh, if I did it whenever the mood struck me, I would be reading all the time instead of writing, which was my problem back as a beginning writer. I read all the time and didn't write at all. So, yeah, I have a routine. I write after breakfast and then, you know, after lunch and then after dinner. So with breaks for exercise, and we go out to lunch, Dean and I, my husband, Dean Wesley Smith, and I. And that's about the only time we leave the house. But that's about it, you know. I make sure I don't read all day by saving the reading for the end of the day and any television or any other storytelling. So I get my storytelling out of the way first, and then I read or consume stories afterward.
You reward yourself. That's nice. The Retrieval Artist. Where did the idea for that story come from?
It came from a combination of things. I had bronchitis, of all things, and I was reading a bunch of novels that I can't even remember what they are, but they were about the witness protection program here in the United States. And I thought, oh, what would the witness protection program be in a science fiction world? And somehow that my first state morphed into the whole Retrieval Artist idea, which then I realized after I wrote the first novella was much bigger than I expected it to be.
I found the term Retrieval Artist an interesting one because it implies a talent as much as training. Why a Retrieval Artist instead of simply a bounty hunter?
Well, because retrievalists aren't bounty hunters. They are they don't just go for whoever pays them. There are, in the retrieval artist world, there are trackers. Those are bounty hunters. But the retrieval artist, actually the art comes in when they're trying to choose what cases to even take, and most of them they don't, because the politics and the ethics and everything are so dicey in that world that if they take the wrong case, people will die. And they retrieval artists actually care whether or not their clients or the people that they're searching for live or die. So they have a lot of issues to weigh that a straight bounty hunter or tracker would never weigh. If you're just going for the money, you go for the money. You don't care what the result is.
The laws in that world are pretty complicated, or at least pretty, arbitrary. How do you kind of set things up to have a law that makes sense enough for the storyline to go forward?
Well, I don't think they are arbitrary, actually. I actually base them a lot on what goes on planet Earth right now. My biggest complaint about science fiction in general is that it is not alien enough. There are places on this Earth that are more alien among humans than there are on aliens in other people's stories, or, you know, in Star Trek or whatever. And if you look at some of the customs, the laws, the expectations that we have as humans with other humans, you know, our cultures sometimes don't mesh at all. And yet we have agreements and treaties and trade and all of that, and work together back and forth, and actually have extradition laws and various things. And so I based it on things that actually exist. Usually all that I've made up is based on something that exists in one way or another. And I'm trying to be real rigorous about it. If you look at existing law in the world, it is arbitrary. I'm also in one of my nom de plumes is mystery. And someday I hope to write a series of mystery stories set in the past about crimes that are no longer crimes here in the United States. And, you know, selling birth control was a crime once upon a time here in the United States. There are things like that, you know, letting your wife own property was a crime in the United States. And so, you know, laws are, they come out of their culture. And so the culture has to be consistent before the law is consistent. And when you're looking at it from the perspective of a person who's not involved in that culture, yeah, it will seem arbitrary and it'll seem strange. But from the perspective of the culture itself, it makes complete sense.
You mentioned that when you finished the story initially, that it was much larger than you originally thought it was going to be. How does the process work to transition a short story or a novella into first a book and then an entire series?
I think the way that I manage to approach a lot of what I do is write a short story first. I lie to myself and tell myself, oh no, it's only a 5,000 word short story. And then as I dig into it, I realize, you know, I'm not dealing with this implication and that implication. And I want to explore that part of the world and that part of the world. And suddenly I have this huge project on my hands. And I probably had it before I wrote the short story, but I wasn't going to admit it to myself. It's a different process depending on the story I'm telling. In the retrieval artist world, the actual novella, the Hugo-nominated novella, is written toward the end of Miles Flynn's life. A lot of stuff has happened to him. And I went back with the first novel called The Disappeared, and that's set at the point at which he decides to become a retrieval artist, which is years in the past from that first novella, which is causing me no end of headache nowadays, because I have to kind of keep that novella in mind. But,
That's what happens when you peek at the end of the book first.
And I do if the book is scary.
He gets you into trouble.
I know.
Well, the diving into the wreck had a similar origin, and I thought it was interesting that you based that off of your husband's scuba diving search and rescue.
Yeah, he does, or he did, a lot of that, and he has some very scary stories about the search and rescue in particular. The scuba stuff is just interesting, but boy, some of the stories he has told about, you know, diving for dead bodies or trying to save people are just hair raising. And I thought, ooh, that sounds kind of space opera-y. I wonder how I can translate that into a space opera world. And then I ended up with diving into the wreck with, of course, the historic side, because that's, Dean is also really interested in the Titanic, and so of course he got me interested in old ships. This was long before the movie. So, you know, there's that whole side of things too. Plus we live on the Oregon coast, so we deal with, ships washing up all the time and stuff washing up and things coming out. So it was a combination of things that all combined in my head to come out with the first diving novella.
Your main character's boss, who has a very clearly stated hands off, I want to be alone kind of attitude. And she even has difficulty when she starts taking on crew, kind of interacting with people. How do you keep the character of boss from isolating herself from the readers as well?
I'm not sure I do. I find boss somewhat sympathetic, but, you know, looking at reviews and hearing from readers, people say, oh, she's so off-putting. And I think, well, yeah, I guess so. Probably because she doesn't like people around her. But I think the only way you can deal with a difficult character like that is to understand her. And I do the best I can to explain who she is. But she really doesn't like people, and she does like to be alone. And as the books progress, you'll see in Boneyards, she has to deal with people more and more, and that's quite a problem for her.
I thought it was interesting. It seemed to be perfect that you use first-person perspective with a character like that.
Yeah, she's very self-involved.
As obvious from what you've just said, you're a pretty organic writer. You don't work from outlines. You start with a short story and watch it grow. Things get added. Does that cause problems with the details when you get to the third book in the series? I mean, how do you keep those details consistent?
It doesn't cause problems with the details by the third book. It causes problems in the actual writing. Not only am I an organic writer, but I write out of order. And I don't know why that is. It's like I have pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, and then I have to put them together. And it sounds more complicated than it is. If I think, oh, we need to describe the gun, and I write on page 20 with the description of the gun, and then I get to page 300, and I think, oh, I haven't described the gun, and I describe the gun on page 300. If I compare those two descriptions, they're exactly the same. which really freaks me out. They're not even similar. They use the same words and everything else. So that's how my brain works. But I have to make sure that when I then put the book in its chronological order, that I haven't assumed that you already knew something that I knew, but came out later in the book. And that's the real difficulty for me, is I have to have a couple of first readers to make sure that everything is in the proper order for the reader who's reading it from front to back instead of inside out like I write it.
Yes. You have to be sure that A comes before B.
Yes, and sometimes as I'm writing, you know, V will find its way right in the middle of the book and you go, wait, where did that come from?
So what are the challenges in writing a futuristic detective versus the more traditional series, like the Smokey Dalton series you write as Chris Nelscott?
I think they both have their own challenges. The futuristic one, the nice thing is I get to make it up. And so I can make up the rules and the laws and figure out how it all works. And then, of course, I have to keep it internally consistent. When I'm dealing with the Smokey Dalton series is set in the late 1960s, early 1970s, I have to be accurate. And there are certain things that we didn't know then. There are things that we can't do that couldn't be done. There was one of the books, I think it was Smoke-Filled Rooms. Smokey was trying to run from somewhere and he had to get a hold of everybody. And as I'm in the heat of writing it, I thought, oh, he'll whip out his cell phone. No, he has to find a payphone. Oh, does he have money for the payphone? Oh no, how much does the payphone cost? And so I had to, you know, stop and figure out, you know, was it a dime or a quarter at that point to make a phone call? And, they both have their own struggles, but the real key is to make sure that the detective in my futuristic is not the same detective as in 1970, because people are different depending on where they live and how they live, and I have to have all of that be part of the story.
Yes. You seem to have answered my next three questions.
I knew that.
New Smokey Dalton novel coming out in spring 2012?
It'll be a little later than that. It looks like it's going to be the end of 2012, the beginning of 2013. I was supposed to be researching in Chicago this fall, but we lost a friend and, we ended up inheriting his estate. And so instead of going to Chicago, I was working with the estate. So that's going to put things behind. Even though I've lived near Chicago, I've been in and out, I have more research materials than I ever need. I do like going back just before I do the next book, just to kind of get the city in my head.
Well, on a lighter note, you publish romances under the name Christine Grayson. Many authors with a really solid science fiction fantasy reputation or mystery genre reputation, they don't bother with romance. Why does it appeal to you?
Oh, the big secret here is that I became a science fiction writer because I wanted to be a historical romance writer, and I didn't think I was up to doing the research. Little did I know that the romance field would move beyond me and that historical romance writers stopped doing research years ago. But at the time, I thought, oh, I better do something I can just make up. So that was my lead into science fiction, that and the fact that I met Kevin J. Anderson in college, Kevin J. Anderson, who does the Dune books, and he told me, you know, you're writing a lot of fantasy, Twilight Zone-y kind of stuff, and showed me that there were markets in that direction. But I've been a romance reader from, probably the age of 12. I'm one of those omnivorous readers. I didn't know there was such a thing as genre until, again, Kevin told me in college, and so I just figured everybody read everything. And, so I guess that's how I ended up being a writer who writes everything. There were years where I didn't admit my romance addiction, and nor did I admit the fact that I wanted to write romance. And then one of my books sold into romance, and I went, oh, well, I guess it's time to come clean.
Well, why did you decide to modernize fairy tales and myths in your romances? Why that particular area?
Oh, you make it sound like a decision. I got asked by John Halvorsen and Marty Greenberg to write a short story for one of the Daw book anthologies called, Warrior Wizards or Wizard Fantastic or something. Anyway, it had to have war and it had to have wizards. And because my mind doesn't work like anybody else's, I came up with, one of the evil stepmothers fighting over Prince Charming to keep Sleeping Beauty alive. And so, of course, logically, Prince Charming would hire a lawyer to keep Sleeping Beauty, who's still in a coma, out of the hands of the evil witch. it seems logical to me. It doesn't seem logical to anyone else. And everybody else says, wow, that's so original. And that was published under my Rush name. The story is called The Strangeness of the Day, and it actually won the Prix Imaginale Award in France. But I finished it, and Dean said, as he often says to me, you know, that's a novel. And I went, oh, no. And he was right. Not only was it a novel, but it was a series of novels. And, you know, if you deal with one fairy tale creature, you have to deal with all the others, too. So I'm dealing with them.
Have you watched any of the new TV series that are built off of the fairy tales? Like Once Upon
a
Time?
I had high hopes for Once Upon a Time, and I thought the first episode was wonderful. The second episode went nowhere, and I'm not interested in any of the rest. I am adoring Grimm. I just love Grimm. It appeals to me on all kinds of levels. And it's being filmed in Portland, which is about 2 hours away from me. And they're actually using Portland, which is lovely, unlike the TV show Leverage, which is filmed in Portland but says it's Boston. So it's fun on that level. But I think the storyline's fun. I think it's got a lot of good directions to go in. I'm interested in the Snow White movies that are coming up in the spring, and we'll see what happens with those. It seems to me you either do fairy tales really well or you don't do them at all. It fails miserably. And I know people really like Once Upon a Time, but I don't think it's going to last past a season or two. People are going to get bored. Right now they're still excited about it, but I think they'll get bored.
They have great costumes.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's beautiful to watch.
Nice novelty.
Right. You co-wrote many of your, let me step back. You've written a number of franchise novels as well, especially for the Star Trek series. What's it like playing in someone else's world, and how can you make a novel your own while writing with other people's characters?
Well, that's a really good question, how to make a novel your own. Some of it's voice, but you have to be very careful because you have to stay in the voice of the characters. With the exception of Star Wars, and I'll get back to that in a minute, most of my tie-in work was with my husband, Dean, and we had a real system for working on the books. Dean would come up with the idea and the plot, and usually that's where the originality was, because he has this way of looking at science fiction, I wish he'd write more of it, that is so original. And some of the Star Trek plots that he came up with, one of the editors there, who is an old-time science fiction fan, said he didn't think a lot of what Dean came up with had ever been done in science fiction before, let alone in Star Trek. And then my job was to come in what I called color. You know, he put in the lines, and then I colored inside them. I made the characters sound like the characters and did the setting and all of that. And to be honest, I had the easy job. With Star Wars, I wanted to go back to the original movie, which is what I fell in love with, the first three. And the characters had moved away from that. And I tried to tell a story that took us back to that kind of space opera in which the spaceships go whoosh kind of stuff. And I had a great time writing it, but it took a lot of thought to come up with something that would actually take us back to the original. And that was more work than I think I really wanted to do, which is why I like doing it with Dean more often if I do tie-ins.
I hear the people from Star Wars are great to work with, though.
They're wonderful to work with. I had a great time, and they've treated me well throughout the years. I still get contact from them, and they're really wonderful. They give you a lot of material. They make you comfortable. They help you. They answer questions, which on some tie-in worlds, and I've done other ones, you know, mystery ones and other things, they just kind of threw you to the wolves and said, here. And those were never any fun. The Star Wars was a lot of fun.
Okay. Let's take a break for some music, and when we come back, we'll talk with Christine some more.
Like a summer's day, you questioned life and lost your faith. You needed to believe in something that your eyes had never seen. And now you found that you can't find the answers to the questions that you had in mind. It's like a dial tone, no one's on the line, and now you're feeling so alone. Universe acceptable in your mind? Is
the universe acceptable in your mind? Is the universe acceptable in your mind? Or do you need to see an explanation for the mystery? Trust your heart, it knows the way. In yourself, you need some faith. Don't listen to the crowd. No one's got this whole thing figured out. Listen to the voice inside, the inner self you long denied. The day that you were born, you were given ill. Acceptable in your mind? Is the universe acceptable in your mind? Or do you need to see an explanation for the mystery? How many bright suns shine upon the lucky ones who wander? Explanation for the mystery.
That was Universe Acceptable by Ash Ganley on the album Universe Acceptable, which you can find on the Magnatune.com website.
Your website is a rich resource, not only for authors wanting more understanding of the publishing business, but also people like Kagea and myself, who follow the industry as readers. What prompted you to start sharing your advice?
Well, I've done it off and on for years. 20 years ago, Dean and I started teaching something we called the Chris and Dean Show, because we had learned from other writers that you can't pay back what you've learned, but you can pay forward and help new writers. So we would often give of our time for an entire weekend just teaching people new stuff. And that was while we were doing Pulp House and FNSF, the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, and and doing our own writing. And somewhere along the way, somebody convinced me to start doing blogs and doing all of that. And so I, put up a website, did an occasional blog. But it wasn't until the recession started, the entire economic collapse of 2008, that I looked around and I went, I had been meaning for years to write a how-to book on how to be a freelancer, not just a fiction writer or anything, but a freelancer, because I've done so many different freelance jobs, and I never got around to it. And here it was, I had a quarter of a book done, and by the time it got published traditionally, it would be too late. The people who would need it, who have lost their job in the recession and are starting a freelance career, it would have already started and probably failed, because most people fail about four times before they actually succeed. So I talked to a friend of mine, his name is Michael J. Totten, and another friend of mine named Scott William Carter. Mike Totten has one of the most influential international bloggers out there. He writes about the Mideast. And I said, how do you go about actually having a monetized blog on your site? I kind of wanted somebody to pay me to write the book a little bit, if they felt like it. I didn't want to
charge money to get into the site. I just felt, you know, if you got a value, then you could pay money. And if you were one of those people who couldn't afford to pay, you could still read. And they explained to me how to set it up. And Scott actually helped me set it up. And that's how I got started. And of course, the thing grew like crazy and it's huge. And then I finished it a year ago, August. And I thought I'd like to continue doing this. And by that point, publishing had changed so much. I tried to do a general business blog for a little while, and I thought, you know, this is just silly. I'm always not talking about the elephant in the room. It's time to start talking about the elephant in the room, and that's the change in publishing. So few people know as much about publishing as Dean and I do, because we had a publishing company. We've both been editors. We've edited book lines, and we've edited, you know, short stories and magazines. And then, of course, we're writers, too. And we jumped whole hog into the whole new world of indie publishing in addition to doing traditional publishing. So all the various aspects, I think we've done everything except be agents. And we know all this stuff, so it's time to start sharing it without leaving home and going off and, you know, giving weekend-long talks. And it's turning out to be good. It helps me synthesize the information that comes across every week. And there's so much, because things are changing so quickly that yes. It helps me keep track.
You're very open about your own work on there. What sells, what doesn't, what you're trying. Do you ever regret that honesty?
No. No, I started as a journalist. If I'm going to blog about something, I'm going to be truthful. I'm not going to hide information. So if I put it out there, it's out there, and I don't regret it one bit.
It's good to know. I know that when I see other people who write about self-publishing and that, there's always this temptation to think, they're promoting their stuff there. But with you, I feel that your business like about it, it's not behind the scenes.
Thank you.
So has this changed the attitude of publishers towards you, your blog?
Yeah, actually, it has in some interesting ways. I apparently am wielding a little more power than I expected. I needed to get rights reverted on a book from a company that doesn't give rights back. And they quite quickly, and I was later told by somebody within the publishing house, they were told, get her out of here so she doesn't blog about us. And another publishing company, I ended up having some fairly typical trouble with them a while back. And the vice president of the company contacted me immediately. And that has never happened in my career. And I was like, okay, people are reading this that I didn't expect. And I think that's the biggest thing for me. It's you know, best-selling writers are reading it. People in the industry are reading it. I was actually initially doing this for writers who are in the mid-list and beginners, but it turns out everybody's reading it.
Are you worried that having got you out, they won't let you back in? Are they going, we don't want to have to deal with her?
I'm sure there are some people like that who are going to treat me that way. And I really don't care. First of all, you know, indie publishing allows me the opportunity that even if I'm blacklisted from all of publishing, I can still publish. But that's not going to happen. And secondly, the thing is, I've been in this business so long that I learned something that old-time writers told me long ago, and I didn't believe them. And that is, writers last longer than editors and publishers and every other human being in the business. So the institutional memory is short on the publishing side. So if they blacklist me from a company, 5 years later, I could probably sell a book to that company. It's really silly on that level. And so even if indie publishing did not exist, I wouldn't be worried about it.
How much time does this leave for you to market your own work? Are you just, is it just turning into the business blog?
Well, I've always used my blog, my website, to promote my own stuff, but to let people know what's out. I mean, if I were to do a critique of my own website, I would tell you it's too busy, it has too much information, and I would separate things out a little bit more. It's hard to find things, but it is what it is now, and I'm too lazy to fix it. I do have different websites. The Retrieval Artist series has its own website. Christine Grayson has her own website. I have to start a website for Kristen L. Scott. Those won't be busy. Those will be pretty static. But it's kind of a ratio of, I figure, 5 to 1
the one being the business blog, I get different readers for that. And everybody else who comes to my site comes for this. I have a free short story on Monday. In the middle of the month, I excerpt a novel. And then I keep people up with what's going on. And I have a recommended reading list, which has yet a different group of readership. So the blog, it's like I'm running a magazine on my blog, which was kind of my hope. And some people only read the nonfiction, and some people only read the recommended reading list, which is the reviews, and some people only read the short stories. And I'm fine with that. In fact, I kind of like that. But it's really neat. I'm always surprised when people say they cross over, that they've read a short story on my website and the business blog. I'm like, really? Wow. I didn't get that.
So you're feeling more in control of your career now?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's the best thing that's happened to writers in the last 5 years, is that we have tons more control of our career than we've ever had. Even if a series doesn't make it through a New York publishing house, if it only goes through two books when they promise four, you can still write the last two books and your readers will be happy. That is such a control that writers never had, unless they were really willing to fork out, you know, tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars. And writers were never in a position to do that. So it's a wonderful world to be in right now.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? So many series have got killed before their time. Oh. you spark memories there.
And they're coming back. That's really nice. Writers are actually reviving them. That's so good for us readers.
But what about the traditional markets? Are you worried that any of them will disappear? Do you think they'll survive?
I think a few of them will disappear. It's just standard business. You know, you have such a tidal wave coming into this business right now that some businesses are going to drown. And that's why I've been reading, I don't know if you saw my blog this past week, where I was reading the corporate reports, but from the big conglomerates. But that's where you're going to see which companies are going to survive and which ones aren't. The big shock for me out of that was just how much money they're making on the change. So the companies that have been in it from the beginning, who understand how ebooks work and how digital publishing works, they're already making money. The ones who are playing catch up right now, those are the ones that are in trouble, and you'll see whether or not they're going to make it. There's a lot of money to be made. They're figuring out how to do it. I think the comparison to the music industry is a good one, in the sense that the record labels are still here.
Yes.
They just don't have the clout that they used to. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen with the book publishers. They're still going to be big. They're still going to be important. There's going to be writers that are only going to want to publish through them. But there's going to be other opportunities as well. And it's going to parallel the music industry in that way.
What about the magazines? They're the ones I worry about. I think about them disappearing into blogs, basically.
Oh, they're not, though. The magazines are flourishing. We're in a new golden age of short fiction, and they're just beginning to figure out how to do it. I was talking to the folks at Dell Magazines, and they were one of the first to go online. You know, they had their ebook edition in addition to their print edition. And the nice thing is they were able to get overseas, where they couldn't before. You know, and I remember that from the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, that we wanted to have overseas subscribers wanted to come with us, and it was prohibitively expensive to ship magazines to Europe. And now they can get copies. And so after all these years where circulation has dropped and dropped and dropped, circulation on all of the magazines who are going digitally and keeping a print edition, the circulation of both is rising, the print edition and the digital magazine. And it's because the digital magazine feeds the print edition, and people will say they'll see the digital example, and then they'll subscribe to the print. And it's an exciting time. I'm thrilled, because I was really afraid the magazines were going to go away, and they're not. They're growing.
Yeah. I was thinking about it was Universe, wasn't it, the magazine Baines started. That was digital. It lasted, what, a year, maybe two?
Oh, no. It lasted a long time. Baines Universe, I think, lasted 5 or 6 years, maybe more. it was Jim Bain's baby, and then Jim died, and Tony Weisskopf, who runs Bain now, had too many balls to juggle at the time, and she just decided she didn't want to continue keeping an eye on that as well as everything else. And I understand that. It did really well for the time period that it was there. It was ahead of its time, and I think the one to watch right now, the two actually, are Lightspeed and Fantasy Magazine. They're doing ebook edition
every month, and then they put up a short story a week on their websites. They have a podcast of a couple of the short stories every month. And then at the end of the year, they put out an omnibus volume of all the fiction that they've done in print. So it's really a neat way of doing things. And I think it kind of combines all the opportunities that you have as a magazine now to showcase fiction. And I hope that they're making as much money as I think they're making. it's really a neat project.
What about the standards with ebooks? Truly appalling copy editing in some of them, and they're still successful.
But there's no copy editing in some of them.
Yes.
Well, and it's actually the traditional publishers that are the worst offenders, which I find ironic as all get out. Because what they're doing is a lot of times they're using scanning technology. They'll scan the actual print book and then put up the scan. And I was reading a romance novel a while back that had been published in 1998. And I was reading it in an ebook copy. And in the middle of it, the hero turned around and farted with the woman. And I went, what? What is this all about? Is this something new and kinky that I didn't expect? Actually, I had to look at it for a minute and realize what it meant. What the reader had read as farting was actually flirting. He flirted with her. And I just lost it at that point. I was just... and there were mistakes like that throughout the entire book. It was very difficult to read. And then, of course, you have the new writers who are coming in who don't think they need editing. So there's that problem. And then on top of everything else, we haven't settled on a format yet. You know, a book that's on the Nook is going to look different than a book that's on the Kindle. That I was just reading a wonderful book that was on my Kindle, and then I read it on the Kindle app on iPad, and it was a completely different book. It was in a different format, and I thought, okay, that's strange. So we haven't settled on format yet either. So we have like three different waves coming together to create problems inside the ebook copy. I think it will get fixed, though.
Yes. People like Amanda Hawkins, I tried to read her, and the plot was good, but gosh, she could do with a copy editor.
Oh, she sure could have. And she hired one. She just hired a bad one, which there are bad ones. Believe me, I can tell you stories from traditional publishing of bad copy editors, too.
Yes.
She's a heck of a storyteller. I mean, that's why her books sold as well as they did, is because people just jumped over. She puts in commas like I do. I used to work on radio, and I just put in a comma wherever I'm going to – when I pause writing, and I pause to think of a word, and I put in a comma, and I have to go back and take them all out. But her copy editor never took them out. She just had hired a bad copy editor. There are a million very good copy editors who are out of work right now, many of whom advertise now online, and she could have hired a good one, and she didn't have to go to traditional publishing for her books. She just needed to hire somebody good as opposed to the person she had hired, and she would have been fine. She didn't understand that. She's what, 23? She's new and young, and she doesn't understand that these opportunities were there for her. She just didn't look in the right place.
She's got so many things, so much on her plate. She just has to fit everything in right now.
Well, it must be absolutely mind-boggling to go from being unpublished and just putting it up defiantly on your own to, you know, making millions of dollars and having huge readership. That must just be a mind-boggling thing, especially when you're that young.
She's handled it very well, I think. I'm a lot more impressed with her attitude to it than a lot of her detractors and her contemporaries.
I think she's marvelous. And I think she's handling things very, very well.
Most people who are doing well with ebooks already had an established name. Amanda came out of nowhere. How do you manage that? What's the secret? What's the secret of becoming known when you don't have a traditional background, but you haven't been promoted by general publishing? How do you stand out in the crowd?
Well, it's a myth that that traditional publishing actually promotes its books. They promote their bestsellers, but they don't promote anybody else. And so you're in the same position if you indie publish as you are if you're a mid-list writer in traditional publishing. And that is, you have to somehow rise above what's called the noise. And the thing that rises you above the noise are twofold, well, threefold, actually. The first thing is you have to tell a heck of a good story. You have to – readers will tolerate, as you noticed, you know, bad copy editing and bad grammar, as long as the story is good. They will not tolerate beautiful writing if there's not a good story in there. That's what readers are looking for. They're looking to be entertained. So if you entertain them, you've got them. The next thing you need is you need a lot of product. You need to have a lot of books, because Amanda Hawking wouldn't have succeeded if she'd only had one book. People would have forgotten about her. But she put up a lot of books, everything, you know, she just gave up and put up all of her stuff, and she had a lot. And so when they finished the first book, they had a second book and a third book and a fourth book to go to. You'll see that the writers who are succeeding, who are unknown when they come into indie publishing, Amanda Hawking, John Locke, they have a huge inventory. And then the other thing that you absolutely have to do is write more. And, you know, it sounds counterintuitive. You should be out there blogging and doing all of this stuff. No, you need to be writing, because readers don't care about your opinion on the latest debt crisis. What they care about is when's the next book about their favorite character coming out. And so what I'm hearing from writers, you know, whether they're traditionally published or you know, initially, you know, well-known that way, or if they're just indie published, is that the readers are keeping them going, because they can't write fast enough suddenly. They don't have that year-long lag between finishing a book and getting it published. They have to get it out there and get it fast, and then the readers want it again and the next one, and it's really happening.
We're junkies, it's true.
Well, I'm that way. You can read a book so much faster than you can write one, and I think there's only one writer on the planet who can write faster than I can read, and that's Nora Roberts. And I think the only reason she can write faster than I can read her books is because somewhere in the middle of the year I get really tired of them and I need to have a break. But if I were reading only Nora Roberts, I would finish before she could get all of her books out too. So, you know, writers have all of that going on. But it's a myth that the only writers who are succeeding, with the exception of Amanda Hawking and John Locke and people like that, are traditionally published writers. Initially, with a background and a following. It's not true at all. We have a group of writers that, because Dean and I have been teaching professional writers now for since the late 90s at workshops in our town, we have an email list. And most of these are names you would never recognize. They're folks you've never heard of. And all of them that have gone into indie publishing are making a good living at it, you know, anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000. You know, with the exception of the short story writers who are making probably $20,000 a year. You're not going to hear their names at that level. They're not making millions like Amanda Hawking and John Locke, but they are being very successful. And it's because they're good writers and good storytellers, and they've found their audience. And I hope their audiences continue to grow.
Yes. I think what we've got to remember is there's a generation out there now who learned to write on blogs, learned to write on the web, and they already had a following, even if it wasn't a print following. So people like, I don't know, David Wellington, maybe.
Oh, yeah, there's that, too. But a lot of these folks that I'm talking about never had a blog. They don't have anything. They just put up a number of stories, a number of books. And this is the fascinating thing to me, is it's kind of like that movie Field of Dreams. You know, if you put it up, they will come. And I don't know where the readers find it. Even if you don't advertise it, they find it. And that's the really neat thing.
I know every time I research an author for the interviews, I find all sorts of magazines out there publishing short stories that I didn't even know existed. And so I've got another thing to add to go back and read, which is wonderful.
Yes. Your feed's getting out of control, isn't it?
It is. You should see my reading lists.
Oh, we complain about the worst things, don't we?
I know, we suffer.
Well, before we end this interview, why don't you tell us about your newest releases and what's coming out soon?
Well, let's see. Let's go by genre first. Let's start with science fiction.
next month on December 1st, Anniversary Day, which is the next Retrieval Artist novel, is coming out. It's already out as an exclusive from Audible in audiobook, but the ebook and the print book will be out on December 1st. I'm very excited about that. With the next one, because you'll see, you need the next one. It'll be coming out in late summer. And then the next Diving Into the Wreck book is coming out in January. That's called Boneyards. And that's coming out of Pyre. It's traditionally published. And then I have a whole new pen name starting up. That's a romance science fiction name called Chris D. Lake. And the first book in that series is coming out in March. And that's called Assassins in Love. And then I have another Christine Grayson book, which is a reissue coming out in June from Source Books. And then WMG Publishing is putting up my entire backlist slowly. And it looks like they will have all of my Fae books out by the middle of, you know, March. And that has me excited because the artist who's German, whose name's Dirk Berger, has done these spectacular covers, and nobody's ever given these books great covers before, so I'm really excited about that, and we'll see what happens with that. And then, of course, you know, the next Smokey Dalton book is coming out in a year, and there will be some other Chris Nelscott projects this summer, and so I'm just kind of happily and busily writing.
Well, I've got a couple of your books that I need to go back and download now, like Greeks in Love. No, Geeks Bearing Gifts.
Geeks Bearing Gifts. That's a short story, and then there's the collection, which is, you know, Geeks in Love, which is the Christine Grayson collection.
There we go. See, you know, I'm like, oh, that looks really interesting. And I read the excerpt from Diving Into the Wreck, and that's going to be on my list, too. So, know what I'm going to read in December. Well, thank you for being our guest today, Christine.
Well, thank you for asking me. This has been a lot of fun.
We will link to Christine's website, her online bookstore, and all the related sites that came up during our interview tonight. And you can find them in our show notes. They will be posted on our website at www.thebookstacks.org. That was Off the Shelf, produced by KK Verardi and Simeon Beresford for Radio Real. The introductory music was 1500 Tons by Burning Babylon from their album Stereo Mashup. We leave you with this piece, Hogaton 14, by the Eternal Jazz Project from their album Gratis Jazz. Both songs are available on the Magnatune label. You can learn more about Magnatune and their artist at their website, magnatune.com. This show is licensed under a 3.0, no derivative, Creative Commons license.